Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com. All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hello, welcome to another episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. I'm Caitlin. I have with me here my co-host, Mark. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm fantastic. So today we're going to be talking about video games.
Yay!
Yeah! We'll talk about what we're currently playing. Then we're going to talk about the retro game Beyond Good and Evil, followed by our feature game, Sifu. And then we'll shout out some games we're looking forward to. So, Mark, what are you currently playing?
I appear to have an as yet not exhausted desire for Vampire Survivors clones. I've talked about Halls of Torment, and indeed, I think it goes without saying that I've played a fair amount of Vampire Survivors. I haven't played any of the new DLCs, though, because I seem to also, in addition to having an unexhausted desire, I seem to have a sort of belief that past $5, you shouldn't have to pay for any sort of bullet heaven game or derivatives. I've been playing Karate Survivor. Now, this isn't really a bullet heaven game, because there aren't really projectiles in Karate Survivor, because you are indeed a practitioner of hand-to-hand martial arts. You're legally distinct from Jackie Chan protagonist, and indeed, I'm rather embarrassed, Caitlin, that you would say that he looks like Jackie Chan. How dare you? Is not capable of slinging out 17 different kinds of whips, 5 crosses, 3 holy hand grenades, and a variety of bat-like projectiles, but instead just acquires new hand-to-hand combat moves. And the thing that initially appealed to me about Karate Survivor is that the animation is lavish. I love well-done 2D animation. I don't think this is rotoscoped, but it looks incredibly smooth. Indeed, the moment you boot it up and you see your little not Jackie Chan, again, Caitlin, he's not Jackie Chan. Stop saying he's Jackie Chan. Doing a sort of flip kick on the developer logo, it's great. I was sold. And on top of that, there's a whole bunch of really good environmental detail. Most of these kinds of bullet heaven or derivative games tend to have very, very stark, minimalistic graphic styles because the job is to be cheap and cheerful and to push dozens and dozens and dozens of enemy sprites on the screen. And those enemy sprites might have as many as 3 or 4 different frames of animation. But Karate Survivor has lots of really good detail for the environments that you're engaging in. So there's a supermarket, there's a bar, there's a construction site. And in these environments, for example, in the supermarket, you might kick open the door to a freezer and a whole bunch of cans might spill out. And in the process, if you have the necessary unlocks, the freezer door will smack enemies right in the face, giving them a bunch of damage and slowing them, and then allowing you to engage them at your leisure. On top of this, Karate Survivor has a couple of mechanical innovations. In addition to the fact that it's all hand-to-hand, it kind of works on a kind of rhythm or tempo, which I find rather fascinating. So in a lot of these other games, your attacks are on a kind of cooldown, but you're not really in a position to internalize too much. Certainly at a later level, what's on cooldown and what's not. Things just happen kind of by themselves, and you're mostly surprised. The way it works in Karate Survivor is you have a list of attacks. You start with 1. You can acquire more as you level up. Typically, you'll end with 6. And there's a cooldown clock between your attack string. So you do your attack string, which is all your attacks in order. And then there's this delay between you start again. And it is during this delay that you are most vulnerable to enemy damage. Not just because you're not doing any damage to them, but also because if you attack at the same time as an enemy on default difficulty, you will not suffer any damage. So if you're able to control the zoning, you're relatively safe from frontal attacks while you're doing your attack string. And managing these periods of offense and defense is really cool. And so I would never find my attention drifting in the later levels like I would often do for things like Vampire Survivors or Halls of Torment. Because frankly, at a certain point, if you're properly leveled up in a lot of those other games, the game starts to play itself in a really aggressive way. But in Karate Survivor, there's lots of visual noise going on, as you might expect. Less so than other games because, again, they're not projectiles. But you can't just stand there in a crowd of enemies between attack strings. You will die. And so you do have to pay attention to what's going on, even at the later levels. And I really appreciated that. There's tons of different things to unlock. Most of them allow you to do new and impressive kinds of martial arts moves. And by the end of it, you're hurling things that are on the ground. You're kicking various objects at people's faces. You're jumping over or under various countertops. You're engaging with elements of the environment to do damage to opponents. You're picking up umbrellas to smack them in the face. And then you're going to do your standard attack string on top of all that. And of course, all these things can be upgraded. All of these things are subject to persistent unlocks. All of these things are lavishly animated. And so visually, I really like Karate Survivor. I found it very enjoyable. And as per usual, this is a question of, can it hold your attention for a certain amount of time, and does it cost $5? And the answer is yes. I've been playing it for about 10 hours since I purchased it, and it costs around $5. And that, to me, we can have a discussion about value. We discussed a lot about that in the context of Thank Goodness You're Here, and I definitely think, I sincerely believe that that is an open question, but I don't think anyone can quibble with 10 hours of enjoyment for $5. That is solid return on investment right there. And I just find it a delightful variation on the existing theme. And I really like that this sort of indie subgenre is really flourishing and letting a thousand flowers bloom in a lot of different contexts. And so I have been playing Karate Survivor. I think I might be done. I have unlocked, I've unlocked the five environments. I have beaten the final boss on all the five environments. I seem to not be unlocking any new moves. And consequently, things have started to fall into a kind of pattern where I'm not really seeing anything new run. And so as a result, I don't think I'll be going back to it much. But as I say, already sunk 10 hours into it. That's a very, very good amount of gameplay. And I was very pleased to have checked it out. So again, if you're into this kind of game, obviously Vampire Survivors is the progenitor and still very good. I enjoyed Halls of Torment and I also enjoyed Karate Survivor.
Yeah, this game looks awesome. Like the animation looks really good. I'm kind of impressed just watching the trailer. Yeah.
Yeah. And stop saying he looks like Jackie Chan.
I have never once said that, Mark. I feel like you've been the one who's been saying that.
No, that sounds like fake news to me.
Hmm. Do you level up and then get to add new attacks to your attack string? Is that how that works?
So when you level up, you're presented the option of three possible upgrades. Some of them are just passive buffs to your existing attack, like increasing attack range or increased probability of doing a critical hit, etc. Or sometimes you're given the possibility of giving a new attack entirely. And an attack is defined in terms of where it's going to hit. Most attacks hit forward, where your character is facing. Facing matters a lot in Karate Survivor. But sometimes it's to the back, sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. Sometimes it's all over the place, like a sweep kick, for example, will attack in a variety of different directions. And they have different colors, and there are synergy bonuses for lining up attacks of the right color next to each other, and there are further synergy bonuses if you line up attacks of the right number in ascending order. It's not, this is a bit of a stretch, it's not like Balatro or anything, but it's kind of like setting up a poker hand. You get better bonuses for those things. And things do get more impressive. Again, never quite to the level of a fully upgraded weapon in Vampire Survivors or anything of the sort. But you do, however, get one thing that was missing from Halls of Torment. And I remember commenting negatively on Halls of Torment that they don't have this. You do get chests in Karate Survivor. And it's just like chests in Vampire Survivor. There's a little rainbow and you get that dopamine hit and something great pops out. And it's all very pleasant. And it appeals to my lizard brain.
Nice. Good.
I can't remember how deep into this sort of bullet heaven subgenre, again, even though that term isn't particularly accurate for all games, whole have you gone? You've played Vampire Survivors, right?
I have played Vampire Survivors. I made the mistake of playing it on my phone And I mean, okay, it's fine on the phone, I guess, but I don't feel like I can get the movement that I want to be able to do very easily with my fingers on the screen. It's not my favorite way to play. I really wish that I'd play it on the computer because I think I would have played a lot more if I'd been playing on PC. And at this point, I'm just kind of waiting for a way to transfer my data somehow from my phone to the computer game. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but...
Well, I can tell you what I can do, Caitlin. I could send you an Android emulation device with built-in controls, and then you can install your Vampire Survivors and move around with a joystick.
My main concern is my save state, and I'm playing on iOS.
Oh, I forgot that you play on the... Of course.
Yeah.
Sorry. I forgot you're one of them.
I am one of them.
My mistake.
Especially because it's iOS. It's like, I don't know. Maybe it's never going to happen. But I should try one of these other games. I have this sunk cost into the iOS version of Vampire Survivors. And honestly, it probably wouldn't take that long to just do everything over on the PC. But...
I completely respect your not wanting to unlock everything over again. It is tedious and daunting. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense to me. So what have you been up to lately, Caitlin?
So I'm in a little bit of a slump post-Veilguard. I just haven't wanted to play anything.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've played a bunch of stuff, just nothing for very long. So I did A Park Full of Cats, which was the last Full of Cats game that I needed to play.
Cats for you?
Nope, I have to wait until a new one comes out. There's other games by that developer, but they aren't the same, like, you know, find the kitty and click on it.
Right.
So I haven't tried all of those yet. But I played that for a little bit. I mean, that took maybe 2 hours to finish, but it was fun. Then I played... Okay, so a while back, I was like, I really want to play Tokyo Jungle, because I haven't thought about that game in years, and... I remember being dumb and fun, and so I got my old fat PlayStation 3 out, and it didn't work, and I was like, damn it. So then I made a very wise financial decision to find another PlayStation 3, meaning I needed to get the fat one repaired because it's one of the like original ones that can play PlayStation 2 games.
Yes.
So I like that. But I need to get it repaired, and I just didn't want to put the time or money into it quite yet. So I found a cheap PlayStation 3 Slim. I think it's a Slim, not a Super Slim. I don't know the difference, honestly. But anyway, I got one. I got it all set up. I had to install a system update, and then I had to download the App Store, and then I had to update the App Store, and then I had to download Tokyo Jungle, and then I had to update Tokyo Jungle, but I finally got to play Tokyo Jungle.
I'm amazed that all of those things worked.
Yeah.
These are all just things that Sony has maintained to this day?
Apparently.
Good for them.
Of course, after I did all of this, my sister's husband was like, yeah, by the way, I'm pretty sure you can just play that on like PS Now or whatever, like their streaming service. So I probably didn't have to do all that work that I did, but that's okay. So... Anyway, I played some Tokyo Jungle. The tutorial was annoying. I ended up having to do it twice, and I don't really know why, but I got to play a little Pomeranian and, you know, take over some territory.
You had to remind me about Tokyo Jungle, because this is a truly gonzo idea. Tell the people what Tokyo Jungle is all about.
Okay, so Tokyo Jungle. People, humans, mysteriously disappeared... I don't know, sometime before the start of the game. I forget exactly how long.
I love the implication that there are some people that are not humans. Go on.
I mean, I'm just trying to be explicit. I don't know. The city of Tokyo, and probably the whole world, but the game takes place in Tokyo, has been completely taken over by animals. So there's house pets, there's zoo animals, there's just a variety of animals. All of them are wild and feral at this point. And the very first animal that you get to play is a tiny little fluffy Pomeranian. There's also the option of playing a deer. please don't die, Mark.
Oh, you're killing me.
So you can play... The animals fall in one of two categories. They either can be a herbivore or a carnivore. Carnivores have to hunt other animals in order to survive. And then the herbivores just have to find plants. Gameplay-wise, there's a lot of... I mean, if you're playing an herbivore, it's all stealth, basically. You need to either outrun the predators, or you need to hide in the grass and sneak around them. Even playing as a carnivore, there's still a lot of stealth because you are still in danger from being attacked by larger, beefier carnivores.
You mean the Pomeranian is not the apex?
It is not, it turns out.
Okay.
I got handily destroyed by like a little Scottish Terrier. I don't know, some sort of small little dog.
Oh my goodness.
But bigger than me.
Yappy dogs.
Yes. So yeah, it's such a weird little game. Like the gameplay loop is basically you have to take over one territory, which you do by finding these different areas to mark. And then after you get enough areas to mark, you have to find a mate. And you are always a male animal, apparently.
Huh.
I don't really know why. But after that, you have to go find an eligible lady animal. And you have to find, I guess there's different qualities of eligible lady animals. There's the black heart, which means like she's not so great. And then I think there's a pink heart, which is, you know, she's fine. And then there's another one that I don't know if I ever saw. But that's like the fancy one. Honestly, okay. I forget what this means. But basically, you find her and then you bring her back to the nest. And then very awkwardly, you see your Pomeranian or whatever other animal mount the female animal. And then it fades to black. And it's like, that
oh
just
my
seems
goodness.
Unnecessary.
I would have assumed that they would have faded to black much sooner.
So would I. But nope, that's not how it works in Tokyo Jungle. And then
apparently not.
You come back, I guess it unfades to black, and there's going to be a bunch of baby animals. So in my case, again, I was playing the Pomeranian, so I had like 5 little Pomeranian puppies running around, and you get to control them, and apparently you can like order them to attack as a pack.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, anyway, so Tokyo Jungle, that's the whole gameplay loop. You grow up. You take over territory, you have to make sure you eat, you have to maintain your health because you get attacked, you have to maintain your hunger, and then you just keep moving on with your generations. There's also a lot of quests, or not even quests, more challenges to complete in the game, and completing certain challenges will let you unlock other animals. So I unlock cats, for example. In order to unlock the cats, my little Pomeranian dude had to kill a whole lot of kitty cats. It was a little distressing.
Well, as befits the murder machine that is your modern cat.
Yeah, these were some mean cats. So the first time I played, I think I'd unlocked at least one of the larger predators. But I didn't play too much this week because, again, I'm in a little bit of a slump ever since I finished Veilguard. And then I played a little bit of Metaphor ReFantazio, which I didn't get too much further in. I still really like that game. I'm having a hard time.
Okay, well, we'll circle back to that in just a second. I just have 2 more questions about Tokyo Jungle, if you don't mind.
All right.
Number one, I had thought, I was mistaken. My memories of Tokyo Jungle are like 10 years old, because I do remember how strange it was when people were talking about it. I never played it back in the day. I thought it was an always online kind of deal.
I know for sure that there's 2 game modes. One is survival, and one is story. I don't really know what story is because I tried to start story and it made me do the whole tutorial over again, but then I didn't really have anything I can do. I think you unlock a tiny little portion of story level every now and then by doing challenges and survival, but I'm not really sure. I couldn't remember what any of the online stuff would be, and I didn't see anything that seemed to require me to do stuff, but anything is possible. I also could have just missed it. Okay, so there was some DLC which just had other animals, and it cost like $5 for everything. So I tried to buy it, but that part of the PlayStation 3 store was not working. So damn it.
Okay.
But anyway.
My second question is, and this is more fundamental to sort of media design more generally, and that is, I have observed in the past that many forms of media, not just video games, are very loath to show animals dying, mm-hmm. either at the hands of the player character or in any other context. My inference is that Tokyo Jungle does not have any such compunction.
Oh, not at all. It was a bloodbath in there.
Okay. Dead puppies all over the place.
Yeah, like at one point I walked, in order to do the challenge to unlock cats, I had to defeat the cats that were running like Shibuya or something. I forget. It was some district in Tokyo. I know. So I had to go there, my little cute, you know, brown Pomeranian, and I had to murder like 30 cats. There were a lot of bodies over the place, Mark. If you Wild. Eat them, so you can, like, you know, eat the things that you kill, and eventually sure. They will become a little pile of bones instead of a dead cat body. But there were a lot of dead cats.
Wow.
And also there's, you know, there were a lot of little dead Pomeranians when I brought my my Pomeranian brood in there, because a lot of them died to the cats. It was rough.
That sounds like such a scene.
It's a jungle out there, Mark. A Tokyo jungle.
You feel good about that, Caitlin?
No.
Okay. Thank you so much for giving us a tour of Tokyo Jungle, specifically Shibuya, formerly run by cats, now a graveyard of cat bones and the surviving members of a Pomeranian brood. So you say you're in a post-Veilguard slump. So having, we know that you finished Veilguard and that you enjoyed it a great deal. And is it just that you're kind of coasting on your memories of Veilguard, or you played so much so quickly that you're kind of burnt out a little bit on video games in the immediate aftermath? What would you care to characterize this slump?
Yeah, I think it's more like after I finish something that I was really, really into, nothing else just feels engaging for a little while. And like, I always come back to it eventually, but especially yeah. in the immediate aftermath, just like, man, I guess what I really want is to just be playing more Veilguard, but I finished it. So right. I don't actually want to play more Veilguard. So
that makes sense to me. All right. So that's what we've been up to lately. We're now going to move on to some gaming opinions on old school funware goof. We're going to be talking about Beyond Good and Evil. Beyond Good and Evil was written by Friedrich Nietzsche. It was after his iconoclastic Thus Spake Zarathustra, and represents sort of a transition from his more aphoristic style to his more polemic style, as exhibited by his follow-up work, The Genealogy of Morality. Caitlin, what were your thoughts on Beyond Good and Evil?
Mark, I think we might have done different Beyond Good and Evils.
This is terribly embarrassing.
The one I played had a pig in it named Paige.
Why would you make a game with a pig in it named Paige and call it Beyond Good and Evil?
Unclear at this time.
Is it about the will to power?
I have no idea. I don't think so.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell us about this one, then?
Okay, well, this one is about a woman named Jade, who is I think she's a photojournalist. She certainly has a camera, and I believe she does reporting stuff. So that's Jade. She has a friend named Paige, who is a large pig man, and they are good buddies, and I guess they live in this lighthouse kind of area that has a whole bunch of orphan children in it. And in fact, I believe Jade herself was an orphan child as a result of this war, where just every now and then, these really creepy alien centipede things just come down from space and kidnap people. Yep.
So this was a GameCube release in 2003 by Ubisoft, and you played it on original hardware, correct?
I did, yes. That was a whole thing, too, because, you know, I had to find the GameCube, then I had to find the cables, then I found my controller, but it had that sticky, like, old plastic slash rubber thing going on, so oh, then yeah. I had to clean the controllers, but yes, I did play it on the GameCube once all of that was sorted.
Okay, well, I emulated mine on the Embernic 406V, and I was never a big GameCube guy. That was one of the Nintendo consoles that I mostly skipped. Mm-hmm. And I will say that in terms of the hardware itself, I thought that the graphics have aged very, very well. Visually, I think yeah. it's a pretty well-done game.
I completely agree. It was really fun showing it to my daughter, because when we first started up the GameCube and it did the cute little GameCube animation, she was like, what's that? It's like, well, Kerrigan, you know how we have a Switch? Before the Switch, there was a Wii U. And before that, there was a Wii.
Give you a crash course in the genealogy of Nintendo products, right?
Yes.
Which actually raises a large question about what constitutes a retro game. Some people would assert that the GameCube is on the wrong side of the division. I don't have a hard and fast opinion on what constitutes a retro game versus not a retro game. I think you once said, possibly in jest, that any game that's old enough to vote is eligible to be a retro game. And that seems reasonable enough for our purposes, I guess. But yeah. I actually like, insofar as I think there is a rigorous distinction, I tend to follow the one by my friend TechTweeb, who said that if it wasn't in HD, then it's or it can be a retro game. If it's in HD, the moment we get into PS3 and related systems of that era, that's when it's no longer a retro game. But whatever, we can set all that aside. I think that Beyond Good and Evil definitely gets to qualify. Can I just mention a pet peeve that I have about games of this ilk? Because it really, really angered me. And this is the same reason why I bounced off of Hearthstone and why I hate a lot of modern Blizzard products. I'm not saying it's racist, but it's lazy and dumb when you have a whole bunch of people with bad accents. Right? Like, everyone, it really sounds like some white dude trying to sound like somebody from Jamaica. It really sounds like, I'm very sorry if these voice actors are actually giving indigenous accents. I genuinely can't tell. It just doesn't sound very authentic. It sounds like a caricature. And I don't object to the fact that they're rhino men. That's fine, whatever. But there's just a certain kind of vibe that I got from Beyond Good and Evil that, as I say, reminds me of a lot of the things that caused me to react badly to Hearthstone, of a bunch of kind of caricature-level accent work that just struck me as juvenile, frankly.
Yeah.
The overall tone of Beyond Good and Evil is really weird because, as you said, there's this war story. Jade is kind of a war correspondent slash assassin slash revolutionary slash hovercraft pilot. More on that later. And then there's Paige, who is powered by farts.
Yep.
There's a kind of tone that I kind of associate with some children's cartoons, where they're trying to do something more substantial, and they're playing with themes that are quite interesting and weighty, but every once in a while they remember that they're a kid's show, and so they have to have some kid's show stuff. Now, I'm talking about shows like Gargoyles, I'm talking about shows like Avatar The Last Airbender, that kind of go wildly back and forth between, hey, in Gargoyles, this character named Macbeth, his goal is to die. That is his highest aspiration in life. He seeks the oblivion of death because of the burdens he's had over centuries of unending life. Now some fart jokes. Avatar The Last Airbender, same deal. This is about crushing responsibility and trying to run away from that responsibility and generations of trauma. Fart jokes. And I got the same vibe from Beyond Good and Evil, and I hate it, Caitlin. I hate it, I hate it, I hate it.
Yeah, it's... The tone is uneven.
And just to be clear, just to round out this critique, not all kids shows have this problem. Mm-hmm. Like, Steven Universe did not have this problem. Legend of Korra didn't have this problem. Two very tonally different shows that were still primarily aimed to be accommodating for children, although not necessarily specifically pitched for children. Anyway, I thought that Beyond Good and Evil was tonally very much like it is mechanically, a whole bunch of different things that may or may not fit together.
Yeah, I thought, I don't know. It's a weird game. You go from, I mean, the very first thing that you do in the game is have a boss fight, I guess, with a giant centipede alien. And then it's like, oh, go take some pictures of cute animals. Well, maybe not cute. Go take some pictures of animals to get some money. Also, here's some rhinos with accents. Also, you know, jump in this hoverboard and like, I don't know. There's a lot going on.
In some ways, I think, again, this is a bit of an interesting time capsule because Ubisoft is now famous and has been for at least 10 years of producing unfocused games with a million different sub mechanisms. And to a certain extent, this is kind of the dry run. This is kind of the prototypical Ubisoft game with a whole bunch of different things that you do. None of them are particularly fleshed out. None of them are especially robust, but they're all there and they're all functional.
Yep, because you can do, so obviously there's combat, there's photography, there's controlling slash, so you can shoot things on your hovercraft and that's your like main method of travel, I guess, across the map. It's, yeah, I don't know. That's all fine.
Yeah, that's just it. Very often you get this vision that it's all just fine. Like, all these things smash together, and all the mechanical elements are perfectly functional. None of them strike me as particularly deficient. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't really feeling a key hook or a key gameplay loop. Now, keep in mind, this is the follow-up project from some of the same people that brought us Rayman. And Rayman, you may not like Rayman, but Rayman is solid and focused. Rayman is I really like the Rayman games, a lot of them anyway, not all of them. I think they're very good platformers. The transition to 3D was awkward, but, I mean, what else is new? But, you know, Rayman Legends and Rayman Forever, and even just the original first two, Rayman, is that how you, Rayman? Is that how you pluralize Rayman?
I have no idea. Raymans?
The follow-up is Beyond Good and Evil, which is a very, very different kind of project. And again, it just feels so scattered. I will say this. There's one aspect that I'm very weak to, and I don't know if you enjoy this kind of gameplay dynamic, but I thought that they did it reasonably well. And then there's the sort of 3D action adventure where you've got a partner with different movement capabilities than you. Mm-hmm. So obviously, I've sung the praises of Ico a bunch of times on the show. Ico, I think, is one of the greatest games ever made. And Ico and Yorda have different movement capabilities, and you have to navigate getting people in the right place. Resident Evil 4 did this rather a lot, where sometimes Ashley would need to go hit a switch so that Leon could go progress. And sometimes Jade and whoever is following Jade around at the given time, mostly Paige, have this same dynamic. And I confess I am weak to that, and I thoroughly enjoyed those bits, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I was working my way through that first main dungeon, and I liked that. There was just the slightest bit of, like, you know, think about how you need to use your characters to get through stuff. That was fun. I liked it. I'm really curious. So I've heard the praises of Beyond Good and Evil sung frequently over the years, to the point where people are still dying for Beyond Good and Evil 2, which I guess is going to be a prequel if it ever comes out.
As of 2022, it is the video game in longest quote-unquote continuous development. It finally beat Duke Nukem Forever.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
That's
been
dire.
In development for 17 years, Caitlin.
Cool. I mean, they claim it's still happening.
Any minute now.
But yeah, I've heard many, many good things about it. I don't know what about it in particular people love so much, but I also know that I am definitely not far enough in the game to, or I don't think I'm far enough in the game to have reached that.
I'm with you. I'm kind of puzzled as to why people are still talking about it 20 years later. It's visually appealing. I kind of like the overall mm-hmm. visual design. And as I say, it does a very good, it makes excellent use of the GameCube hardware. It looks like something that could have even been released in the generation following. But that alone isn't enough to guarantee. Like, there are lots of visually impressive games that people just forget about entirely. And
for sure.
The tonal inconsistencies and the lack of doubling down on any kind of core gameplay loop and the fact that nothing really stands out. I don't know. Maybe some people are really there for the war story and they love the serious elements, and then they want some Paige falling on his face and his weird accent work. I don't know. Maybe that tone and that inconsistency that makes me kind of annoyed is exactly mm-hmm. what people want.
That could be. I have no idea. But yeah, I've been wanting to. I may try to play it a bit more just to see if I can see what people love about it so much.
It doesn't really look or sound very much like a lot of other games. It has its own element of distinctiveness.
That's
the
true.
The gameplay is, on the other hand, is like muddy in a lot of ways that games with too many mechanical elements are kind of muddy. So I have to assume that it's the setting that's doing a lot of the heavy lifting here, because, again, otherwise, like you, I'm somewhat puzzled as to the esteem that Beyond Good and Evil holds in a lot of gamers' hearts and minds.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's a really cool twist in the story. Like, I don't know. I'm not very far. I basically have done that first dungeon. And I also did, like, I accidentally walked into the smugglers thing where they stole my money, and I did that too. That was very annoying. I had to chase somebody through a whole bunch of, like, slowly closing gates, and I lost all of my money in the process because they kept stealing Ouch. 50 credits every single time. But I did eventually get them back, so.
Yeah, I'm not terribly far into it either. I'd venture to say I'm around 4 or 5 hours. And as I say, it was never actively unpleasant, except when I was reflecting on my annoyances with the various patois that these animal-human hybrids were issuing.
Yeah.
But mostly I was just confused. I was like, oh, this is way prettier than it has any right to be. But is it going to settle on a tone? Is it going to settle on a gameplay element? It's not unpleasant. I'm not annoyed overall, even though I found elements annoying. I'm mostly just befuddled.
Yep. I'm with you.
And that is Beyond Good and Evil. First off, let's take a brief break and hear from our sponsors.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
And now let's talk about our feature game, which is Sifu, developed by Slow Clap and released on pretty much everything in 2022.
In Sifu, you are playing the son or daughter of a former martial arts, I believe, instructor who had been murdered by one of his former students a number of years prior, I think eight years. Yeah, so the game opens with you playing the former student of that person, busting into their dojo, I guess.
Well, that's the Japanese term.
Oh, sorry. You're right. This is in China. Yeah, I was like, their house. Wu Guan.
As per usual, it's worth stressing, dear listeners, that we are going to mispronounce many, many things. This is done purely out of ignorance, and we wish no offense to anyone who speaks any Chinese language, because we certainly don't speak any of them.
Yes. He busts in there, he kills a bunch of people, he finally makes it to this martial artist teacher, like his teacher, his Sifu, I guess?
His Sifu, if you will, yes.
Yes. And then he kills him and realizes that the guy's child was hiding in the room and, you know, tells the kid to come out and then orders one of his henchmen to kill them. And then 8 years later, you are playing that child that definitely didn't die because they're apparently immortal. there's like this magic talisman that is able to prevent their death, and that is part of the mechanics of the game. Is every time you die, you age some amount based on your death.
You age 1 year cumulatively. So the first time you die, you age 1 year, then you age two, then you age three, then you age four, then you age five, and so it adds up considerably. There are ways to reset or lower this death counter, but they are very hard to do. But of course, saying that something is hard to do in Sifu is redundant, because everything you do in Sifu is brutally hard.
Yes. I had started on the normal difficulty, and after, so I got through the first two levels, I think, and then I think my character was 60 something years old. And this was after I already had died of old age and had to start the second level over. I decided to go to student difficulty, which is the easy difficulty. And then I was able to eventually beat the game. That makes it much easier because the combos that the enemies do are less complex. And also, you only age 1 year per death, no matter how many times you've died. Yeah, it's tricky. It's not a button masher.
No shame whatsoever. I, too, resorted to easy difficulty for periods of time, although I then did graduate into the normal difficulty disciple, because I have a fair number of complaints about Sifu, but I think it's worth prefacing them with my overall vision of the game's quality. But I'm more curious to hear what your view is. Overall, what did you think of Sifu in terms of, you know, because it's basically a beat-em-up, kind of.
Yeah.
More or less, like, if you had to put it somewhere, it's a beat-em-up. It's certainly not an action-adventure game. You're mostly just beating dudes up. You're beating up dudes and ladies. It's what you're doing.
You're beating up so many of them.
How did you enjoy Sifu overall?
So I have to admit, after I switched to the easier difficulty, I did enjoy it more. Some stuff I still found difficult, or I don't know. I obviously did not have a sense of the timing for many of these enemies and just got hit a lot. It was very frustrating. I thought that the stuff that you did in the game was kind of cool. I liked the different environments that you would go through. I think visually the game is really appealing, especially that third stage when you're going after the artist.
The museum. Oh my goodness,
the museum,
yes.
That was gorgeous. So cool. So I don't know. Overall, I liked it. It was a little, there were parts of it when they're like, I mean, I definitely could hear the message that like, oh, you know, maybe revenge isn't so great and it's just consuming your life. And that was definitely going through the audio of many of the levels. Like even, I mean, that whole museum that you're going through, there's different exhibits that feel like, hey, revenge is bad. Consider not doing it. But it was a little hard to absorb the message while I was destroying hundreds of people on my way to the boss.
Yes. So thematically, I'd say that Sifu is probably pretty weak, but for a beat 'em up is nonetheless pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
There's this idea that vengeance is, as you say, not the greatest of ideas. As you replay Sifu, because it lends itself to replay rather a lot, not just because it's hard, there's the ability to reconsider whether or not you want to systematically murder everybody, or if there's other things you want to do. The somewhat simplistic narrative that were presented that an evil ex-student went and murdered your character's father is kind of interrogated a little bit, but all this is very understated, and I'm not going to say that this is dealt with a particular degree of sophistication or quality. You are here to cave in people's faces. In terms of the quality of that engine to cave in people's faces, I think Sifu is brilliant. I think it's possibly one of the best fighting engines of its type possibly ever designed, because the 3D beat-em-up is a fraught genre that has produced a lot of trash and a lot of failed efforts to do it. And to be fair, there are some elements of the 3D beat-em-up where Sifu does not improve considerably on the formula. One of them being the camera work. The camera sometimes gets in your way and is obnoxious. Don't get caught in the corner. The camera will not help you.
Yep.
Number two, the enemy targeting is sometimes flat garbage. You know, you'll be, I could swear that I'm closer to Thug A and I'll hit an attack button and my character goes off and decides to attack Thug B. It's like, what are we doing here? And sometimes I'll even be holding a direction and my character's like, no, I want to go attack this other guy. It's like, no, yeah. Attack who I'm telling you to attack. Please stop. But despite those niggles, in terms of the fundamental combat engine, I would say the worst part about Sifu, and it's a serious, serious problem, and I mean what I say, the tutorial is garbage. The tutorial for Sifu sets you up for failure because it gives you a very slanted view of how one plays the game, quote-unquote, properly. And my experience with Sifu changed considerably once I, number one, accepted that I was just going to be terrible for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why I bounced off Sifu initially. Like, I was just too full of stress. Because I pounced on Sifu when it first got released. But I kept dying. I'm like, I'm not good enough for Sifu. I'm going to put it aside. You just have to get over that. Accept that you're going to be terrible for a while. It's like the acoustic guitar of video games. You're going to be so awful for a long time, but you have to get past that awfulness. And then number two, I really got over another hump once I finally, this is a very un-Caitlin-like move, I hope you won't hate me for doing this, I started doing some careful YouTube searching for some help on how to manage all this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to leave a link in the episode notes for a video from a YouTuber called Under the Mayo, because what that video does is identifies the ways in which the tutorial is misleading and really emphasizing the things you need to understand in terms of the core combat engine. I mean, I'll just stress one thing. I came away from the tutorial with the solid impression that parrying was a good idea. Parrying is not a good idea. Don't bother. I mean, sometimes it's useful, sure. I also came away with the idea that avoiding attacks was way too hard. It's like, wait, I need to time it correctly and guess whether it was a high attack or a low attack? Ain't nobody got time for that. I don't have reflexes like that. Pro tip, it's always a high attack. The timing is much more permissive on attack avoidance than parrying. Mm-hmm. So that's the way to go. And there's a whole bunch of other things. There's a sea of upgrades. The game gives you no even vague gesture about which upgrades you might want to take. The descriptions are unhelpful. Anyway, all of these things are the kinds of things where I think a judicious tutorial or two from the internet to supplement what Sifu is doing would be very, very helpful. And as I say, the one that I found very, very helpful, I'm going to leave a link in the episode notes below. It's just The fundamentals of defense, poorly explained. The fundamentals of progression, what you keep, what you lose, under what circumstances, because it's got a kind of a roguelite structure, also not well explained, which is a shame. How upgrades work, all these things, what upgrades... It's so much wasted potential because I gotta say, after I finally made sense of these things through help, Sifu completely blew away all my expectations and I started enjoying it so much more.
Yeah, the number of things, like the fact that, so okay, after you complete a level, whatever age you were at when you completed that level is what you're going to start the next level at. What I didn't realize until I read on the internet was, if you feel that you're too old at the end of a certain level, you should replay the previous level because your best age is the one that's going to be saved. I didn't know that, and I don't think that's ever explained.
And the shortcuts that you opened up through the level persist even as you replay. So we talked about the museum level. The museum level, I agree with you, visually is stunning. Thematically is very well done. It's extraordinary. I think it's definitely a showpiece for Sifu at its best. You can, at some point, unlock the elevator for the museum level. And once you've done that, you beat up two thugs in the lobby, and then you go straight to the boss. And that is it. That is the museum level after you've unlocked the key. So if you're inclined to really shave some years off your life, as it were, that's the way to do it. Stumble through the first time, die a billion times, it's okay. Don't worry. Don't sweat it. You can redo it, and you'll want to if you like the combat system, because the levels are relatively short, even without those shortcuts. Even if you have the earlier level shortcut that lets you access the stairwell rather than the elevator, you're still in a position to shave some years off your progress. And so what you have is this kind of classical roguelite progression, where you stumble through failing over and over and over again, but you gradually get these permanent unlocks and permanent upgrades that allow you to do slightly better and slightly better. And all this time, you're also learning how to play better, and then you get to something resembling success. And again, this fundamental gameplay loop, also not explained by the game.
Yeah, I mean, you find a key. Just in the very first level, you find a key that opens a door, and when you get this key, you're like, oh, that's really going to help me. And I'm sitting there thinking, why is that going to help you? We are never coming back here. We did go back there many times, but that was more of a gameplay that's going to help, not that's going to help this character, because this character has no reason to come back to like the slums or whatever the first level was called. So a little weird.
At the point that we're drowning in possibly vaguely Orientalist immortality magic from talismans, I was more than happy to wave away any implausibility as to the setting. Just the give up screen, for example, after you die, is daunting because there's three options and all of them like, well, you keep A and B, but not C. Oh, this one, you lose A, but you keep B, and then you get back to C. It's like, oh, for crying out loud, Sifu, come on. Like, I mean it. Like, Sifu is brilliant. And this tutorial video that I'm recommending, within the first 5 minutes, I was like, oh, that's how this game that I've been playing for 5 hours works. It's wild.
That's fascinating, actually. I kind of want to watch this video because the way that I mainly made it through the game was by parrying, because I had been taught by the tutorial in the game that wasn't skippable, and therefore I did it, that I should be parrying. So I spent a lot of time just trying to parry things over and over and to learn to learn how it worked in order to be able to do it on a regular basis. But that's why I was only able to, like, the first two levels I got down pretty well. The third and the fourth have bosses with ranged attacks, and I had incredibly difficult time parrying everything they did. It was very annoying.
I agree that bosses 3 and 4 are some grade A nonsense, but there are three modes of defense in Sifu. There's your standard block, which requires no timing, but your block gauge is going to get exhausted and overwhelmed real quick. And on top of that, it doesn't open up your opponent to any kind of counterattack. There's parrying, which opens up the opponent to a counterattack and does not deplete your gauge, but requires ridiculously good timing. And if you fail, you're going to eat something in the face. But then there's the avoidance mechanism, which, as I said, the timing in the tutorial is a million times harder than the timing when actually playing the game. and you don't really have to worry about it. You're going to eat the occasional sweep, and maybe if you're really good, you'll remember that some characters have a sweep, but most don't. So just duck everything, and you'll be fine. And then you can counterattack and cause the enemy to enter a stun state. And all of these things are better explained in videos online than they are in the actual game. Yeah, so I adore Sifu. I think it's great. I think it is splendidly done. It's a style of game that I really appreciate, and I think the mechanisms are brilliant. I think they really needed to retool the tutorial. It sets you up for failure. Visually, it's weird. Like, once again, this is an indie game with a relatively poorly optimized Unreal Engine going at it, so like the system requirements are way higher than they need to be. But I cannot criticize them too much, because the first level has a huge set piece that is basically a love letter to the greatest movie of all time, namely Park Chan-wook's Old Boy. That famous, famous, famous hallway fight scene. Have you seen Old Boy, Caitlin?
I have, although I'm realizing I didn't recognize what you're talking about when I played the game.
Oh, okay. Well, there's also an outfit in the deluxe version of Sifu that is an homage to Old Boy. You can dress up your character in the same suit that Odezu wore through much of Old Boy. But anyway, setting all that aside, I'm definitely a fan of that. And just the areas and the environments are really cool. Have you played any of the arenas?
No.
So after, they say you should only go to the arenas after beating the game. Again, I think this is a bit of a mistake, because the early arenas are way too easy if you've already beaten the main game. I don't know what to say about that. But then after you beat the game, there have been subsequent updates where you can go and do these combat challenges. It reminds me a little bit of some of the combat challenges in the Batman Arkham games that were really cool, and I was actually inclined to go back and do that, because I also really liked the combat system in the Batman Arkham games, although I think Sifu's are way better. And it's so you don't have to keep replaying the levels over and over, although I'd be inclined to because of how good they are, but there are also a bunch of different arenas, and there's just a lot of content in Sifu and a lot of room for system mastery, and I, for one, very much enjoyed picking these skills up, again, once I knew what I was doing.
Yeah, so after you beat the game, you also unlock the ability to basically either make the game more difficult, which I definitely didn't want to do, or turn on cheat codes.
No.
But I thought it was cool that after you finish the game, they give you a bunch of stuff that just lets you have fun with doing different things if you want. You can make yourself immortal if you want. I mean, you're already kind of immortal, but you know.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I like that they added all of that.
Well, I'm sorry you found much of it frustrating, Caitlin. Again, I think the game is to blame for a lot of that. But if you have access to Game Pass, Sifu is on Game Pass for both PC and for Xbox. I personally cannot recommend Sifu highly enough. I think it deserves all the plaudits that it got. And in terms of 3D beat-em-ups, I do not think that there has been a better combat system that I've ever played.
Awesome.
I will say, though, that playing Sifu has definitely sapped my interest in spending too much time going back to Veilguard, because, oh my goodness, the quality of Sifu's combat really highlights the extent to which I don't like Veilguard's combat.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not that they're similar games, but...
Yeah, that's too bad. All right, I guess we can move on to shameless hyping of upcoming titles, aka Shout. Mark, what do you want to shout out for us today?
So with the general theme of very violent fisticuffs, I played the demo of Acts of Blood. So this is by Exile Team. This is another 3D beat-em-up. This is actually taking place in Indonesia. I believe the team is Indonesian. So as somebody who very much appreciated the Indonesian martial arts action movies of The Raid and The Raid 2, Acts of Blood was right up my alley. It is not trying to be like Sifu. It is way easier. The combat is much less sophisticated, but nonetheless, I found it very, very satisfying. Acts of Blood is supposed to be released sometime next year. The demo is rough in some places. I hope that these are going to be polished up and finished properly by the time there's going to be a full release, but I, for one, am curious to see how it develops. That is Acts of Blood from Exile Team. Available in demo form right now.
Nice. I hadn't heard of that one. That looks really cool. I'm shouting out Strange Antiquities. Strange Antiquities is the next game from the developer Bad Viking. They previously had done Strange Horticulture. As far as I can tell, they look like they're very similar games. But in Strange Antiquities, you're the custodian of a store dealing in occult antiquities. I had a great time with Strange Horticulture. I played for about 10 hours, and I think I 100%ed it. So I'll definitely be checking out this one. I assume I'll be able to pet the cat again, so that'll be good. These are games that I think technically count as a puzzle game, but it's a kind of puzzle that I enjoy. It's not nonsense. You know, you can find out things by looking through references that you have, and you get to learn stuff. I mean, at least in Strange Horticulture, you got to learn, you know, this is roughly what this kind of plant does, so this is what would be good for, you know, this customer, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I'm looking forward to Strange Antiquities. I don't believe it has a release date yet.
Strange Horticulture was the game where you had clients and you would sell them eldritch-infused plants, right?
I don't think they were necessarily eldritch, but yes, you would sell them plants. I mean, they would use them to, you know, somebody would say, like, I've been having a lot of nightmares lately, and you give them a dream that'll help, you know, help them sleep better.
Oh, okay. Yes, I've seen a number of people play Strange Horticulture, and yes, looking at it now, some of the plants do indeed look very mundane, as opposed to horrific vehicles of nightmare. If anything, this seems like the case where the sequel is doing the more obvious iteration of things, right? Strange Antiquities seems like, if anything, it should have been the more obvious first step than Strange Horticulture, but...
Yeah, I hear ya. Yeah, I don't know. I believe it takes place in the same kind of game world, so that'll be cool. But there is no release date yet, so I'm not sure when it will be out.
I wonder what makes a bad Viking. Were they not good at raiding? Did they wear the ahistorical horned helmets? I don't know.
It's a good question. I mean, probably there weren't a whole lot of game developer Vikings, so maybe that's why they're bad Vikings. I don't know.
There you go. Nailed it. No Jarl wants to raise their children to develop Vidja games. And so they're a disappointment to their clan. So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for All My Best Friends Are Digital. It has been a joy to have you. We really appreciate your deciding to spend some time with us. If you want some ad-free episodes, if you want some bonus content, if you just want to support the show, you can find us on Patreon. We would very much appreciate you taking a look if you're so inclined. But most of all, we hope to see you again soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guaranteed details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.